Prior to Wilson's intervention, the committee had given the special prosecutor something of a free hand. But shortly after Charlie's arrival, the rules of the game changed completely. And before Prettyman could fully deploy his investigators to move on the Murtha case, he was informed that the committee had concluded there was no justification for an investigation. "This matter is closed," proclaimed the newly appointed Ethics Committee Chairman, Lewis Stokes, another of the speaker's reliables. Prettyman was stunned. But bound by an oath of secrecy, there was nothing he could do other than resign in protest. Meanwhile, a teary Murtha had confided to a colleague that Wilson's effort had saved his life. The Murtha rescue operation was one of those small, unrecorded incidents with far-reaching consequences. For O'Neill, the intervention ended the threat to his hold on the House and unleashed him to become Ronald Reagan's liberal tormentor. Wilson would laugh off the incident as if it had been an entertainment. "It was the best deal I ever made. I only had to be on ethics for a year, and I get to stay on the Kennedy Center for life." But he understood that something far deeper had taken place. Relationships had been cemented that would be crucial to Wilson's Afghan campaign. Murtha would rise to become chairman of the awesomely powerful defense subcommittee that Wilson would turn to later when the CIA tried to resist his efforts to up the ante in Afghanistan. Whenever angry agency officials tried to complain about this dangerous meddling, Murtha would always make it clear that when it came to Afghanistan, the subcommittee deferred to Charlie. "The thing about Murtha," says a respectful Wilson, "is that he always remembers." And looming over both of them would be the expansive Irishman with the big cigar, providing a special waiver for Peck's bad boy, Charlie, to cross over the line to work with the CIA. This was how things worked in Tip O'Neill's house. Joanne Herring was one of the few outside Congress who truly understood Wilson's potential. As their romance blossomed, she looked deep into his eyes and got Wilson to spell out for her what he could do with his power. She was thrilled at what she heard and began putting her considerable wiles to work, persuading him to take up the cause of the Mujahideen. Joanne was able to see things in Wilson that were invisible to others. She had cracked Charlie Wilson's code. She understood that underneath his devil-may-care lifestyle, Wilson was deeply ambitious, consumed with Churchillian visions for himself. She considered his womanizing of no particular consequence, the kind of thing that great men with large ambitions are prone to do. She was never disapproving. Instead, she just whispered like a siren into his ear, telling him he could change history. "The Mujahideen need you. You can do it, Charlie. You can do anything you put your mind to." That year, in spite of his many other flirtations, Wilson found himself beginning to fall under Joanne's sway, swept away by her charisma and stirred by her suggestion that he had a special destiny. The war was not going at all well for the Afghans. While they were universally praised for their courage, their cause seemed utterly hopeless. They didn't have any American champions of consequence, and those who did speak for them were a strange and offbeat group. A former Green Beret and Lithuanian American put out a newsletter complaining about the antique weapons the CIA was giving to the Mujahideen. Reporters occasionally quoted him. A handful of enthusiastic right-wing women in New York and Washington knocked on congressional doors, trying to appeal to the Reagan conservatives. And then there was Joanne's friend Charles Fernley Fawcett. The passions of this big-hearted, white-haired American were so touchingly pure, and his efforts to dramatize the plight of the Afghans so tireless, that in 1981 General Zia had awarded him Pakistan's highest civilian decoration. Fawcett had then gone on the road in a quixotic effort to arouse the conscience of a world that didn't seem to care. He had taken his film, Courage is Our Weapon, not only to Baron Rickey's living room, but also to college campuses, salons in Palm Beach, and private clubs in Singapore, strange places where the rich gathered and invariably emoted generously, but did nothing. The high point of Fawcett's efforts came when the well-bred 61-year-old crusader managed to get director William Casey to host a screening of his film at CIA headquarters. In spite of this gesture from the director, Joanne continued to lecture Wilson about the CIA's appalling refusal to do anything of consequence to help the freedom fighters. Now, when Wilson came for weekends to her glamorous River Oaks mansion, She had him share a room with Fawcett in a separate wing of the house to make sure the two got to know each other. Whether it was Joanne's wiles or those large, candid eyes of Fawcett urging Wilson to do his part, the congressman finally threw in the towel that summer and told Joanne and Fawcett that he would go to Pakistan to meet Zia and their Afghans. What he didn't tell her was that he intended to visit Pakistan at the tail end of a scheduled fall trip to Israel. In the political arena, Wilson was not a man to dilute his efforts. As he'd often explained to Joanne, the reason he was able to do so much was because he rarely went to the well, and then only when he knew he could win. His power in the House had come primarily as a result of his work with the Israeli lobby, and the cause that burned brighter than ever for him that year was still the survival of the Jewish state. In the spring of 1982, many of Israel's strongest American supporters had been enraged when the Israeli army, led by General Ariel Sharon, had launched a blitzkrieg invasion of Lebanon under the guise of clearing out PLO strongholds. There was bitter controversy over the attack when Wilson flew into Lebanon, the first U.S. congressman to tour the battlefront. When he reemerged 2 days later in Jerusalem to hold a press conference, it was in the role of an unapologetic Israeli commando, assuring the critics that Sharon had done the right thing. The congressman began his remarks to the newsmen gathered at the King David Hotel by saying, "I come from a district with 400,000 white Baptists, 100,000 black Baptists, and no more than 100 Jews." After establishing his supposedly neutral credentials, he went completely overboard in portraying the attacking Israelis as if they were the uncontested liberators of the people of Lebanon. "They have no complaints except their houses have been blown up," he said. He talked about seeing an old Arab mopping the brow of a sick Israeli with a damp rag. "The biggest surprise I had was the enthusiasm, the universal enthusiasm with which the Lebanese welcomed the Israeli army. In every instance, their voices were of relief and appreciation of the Israelis. That's just the way it is. It ain't no other way." The hard-line Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin was so impressed by this unsolicited endorsement that he sent a transcript to President Reagan and asked for a personal meeting with this marvelous congressman. They met in Jerusalem in Begin's apartment. The old Irgun commando thanked Wilson and asked if the congressman had any advice. "Well, you're not famous for taking advice," Wilson replied. "But if I were you, I would let Sharon clean the PLO out while he has them by the throat before world pressure builds too much." Begin was delighted at this suggestion, but in a matter of weeks, Wilson would find himself back in Lebanon, traumatized by the sight of a massacre that caused him to regret any suggestion he might have made about egging on Ariel Sharon. Meanwhile, Charlie's gushing endorsement of the invasion triggered his first registry on the communist screen in Moscow. The Soviet daily Izvestia ran a mocking column demanding to know how it had come to pass that this American congressman was touring the war zone with the Israeli army. "It is clear that he is a reliable man brought there by American Zionist organizations and the Israeli embassy in Washington." Wilson found out about the Izvestia complaint from the CIA, which monitored the Soviet press and sent him a copy of the article. All of this delighted the congressman, who was reveling in his role as an indispensable protector of Israel. That year, Wilson was also consumed by a grand design that he and his old friend Zvi Rafia had been working on for months with the Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Ahrens. Ahrens had approached Wilson personally with a request to see if he could win a waiver from the U.S. government for foreign aid money to be used by Israel to develop its fledgling fighter plane industry. The fighter jet was to be called the Lavi, which means young lion in Hebrew. For the Israelis, who depend totally on their air force as a first line of defense, the Lavi was considered a matter of the highest national security. It was going to cost $500 million to develop, but according to federal guidelines, U.S. military assistance grants could be used only to purchase American-made weapons. Ahrens and Rafia were asking Charlie to find a way to waive the rules. Wilson was honored. Congress was filled with ardent supporters of Israel, but with this commission, Wilson felt himself advanced to the head of the pack. He planned to return to Tel Aviv in October to finalize his strategy for the Lavi. He had budgeted a few days for the Afghans, but only after he finished with his real friends.